supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Residents of a quiet Wilmington neighborhood are in shock after discovering racist and anti-Semitic graffiti sprayed on a car. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. The incident is being investigated as a hate crime. It comes one day after a similar event in nearby Chester County, Pennsylvania. WHYY's Shirley Min reports.
Early Wednesday morning, residents of a quiet Wilmington street walked out to see a neighbor's car spray-painted with swastikas, KKK, go back to Africa, and other profanity on all sides.
It's gruesome. It's something that I wouldn't want my kids to see or experience that.
Bobby McCormick has lived in the 600 block of Byard Avenue for 10 years. McCormick says nothing like this has ever happened before in the predominantly black neighborhood.
The way they did that car, you know, somebody was brazen because anybody could have walked out the door. Seen them.
Wilmington police are investigating the vandalism as a hate crime, but officers say it appears to be an isolated incident at this time.
And I saw it, and I'm just like, really?
This is neighbor Jasmine Lilly.
You know, like, you wouldn't think in 2017 something like that is going to be happening, especially right across the street from you.
Police don't have any suspects yet, and that is Lilly on edge.
Given what was written on the car, it's like, makes me kind of nervous, you know? I really didn't think that there were people out there like really, really like that. So it's kind of heartbreaking, you know.
About 30 miles away in Coatesville, PA, earlier this week, Janine Humphrey came home after working the graveyard shift to find her car tagged with racist graffiti.
I saw, you know, a Nazi sign on the top of the vehicle as I drove by, and in my mirror, I could see the N-word written across the hood of the vehicle.
Humphrey, who's black, says the hardest part was trying to explain what happened to her kids.
I really just said that that's their problem, their illness, that there's nothing wrong with you, you know, that your skin is beautiful and you're intelligent and you're smart, you know, and you're fully capable of doing anything that it is that you want to do. And, you know, that this person was really just a sick person. And I don't know if they really got it, you know, or really understood it. But I do know today that they were just kind of down. Just the whole vibe of my household right now was just kind of like down.
Humphrey says a convenience store and a garage door about a block and a half away were also vandalized. Coatesville is about half African American, but surrounding Chester County is about 90% white. Coatesville police say George Rissell is responsible. The 24-year-old has ties with white supremacist groups and was arrested. The graffiti incidents in Wilmington and Coatesville come almost 2 weeks after a violent white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, made headlines. Both in our region and across the country, those who track hate crimes and incidents of hate speech say they've been on the rise in 2017. From the Delaware Desk, Shirley Min, WHYY News.
The U.S. Department of Energy says coal and nuclear are still needed to support the nation's power grid. The report was ordered by President Donald Trump's Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, who backs the use of coal and has said solar and wind power threaten the reliability of electricity production. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
The electric grid is in good shape for now, despite tremendous changes in electricity generation. But the report provides some suggestions for shoring up coal and nuclear, including curbing some environmental regulations. Environmentalists had worried that renewables would be slammed in the report. They weren't. The Department of Energy made it clear that the main reason for coal plant closures is competition from newer and cheaper natural gas-fired power plants, much more than regulations or solar and wind subsidies. Andy Ott is executive director of PJM, which runs the region's wholesale electricity market and operates the nation's largest grid, which covers parts of 13 states.
In Pennsylvania specifically, we've seen a huge increase in new gas-fired power generators. And in fact, we've seen a retirement of a significant amount of coal plants. But it's more than just a fuel change. It's really a technology improvement.
Ott says the increase in natural gas plants will help get renewable energy into the mix. That's because natural gas provides flexibility for times when wind and solar aren't readily available. Completely missing from the report is any mention of climate change as a reason to move away from fossil fuels and toward renewables. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The NFL draft was a $94 million tourism boom for Philadelphia. That's according to a report just released by Temple University's Sport Industry Research Center and commissioned by the Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau. Let's take a closer look with Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. Professor, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure.
On the face of it, this three-day event was a big plus for Philadelphia. How do the numbers strike you?
Well, the report that I read a five-page description of is hype. It's a promotional report. It is not credible as far as I'm concerned. They interviewed or had the survey that they prepared filled out by 4,794 people. They don't tell us anything about how those people were selected or make any effort to convince us that those people were representative of the people who attended the event. They say that from that survey, 17% of the people came from out of town and stayed overnight. And they say that there was a direct impact of $56.1 million, which if they're doing it properly, what that ought to mean is that they have identified $56.1 million of spending over and above the spending that would have taken place in Philadelphia had there not been that draft. Now, they don't explain to us where that $56 million figure comes from.
Mayor Kenney's spokesperson, Lauren Hitz, said that the city spent about $500,000 to host the draft. Even if the numbers are exaggerating, if on the face of it, the city was compensated for any expenses over and beyond $500,000, it seems that the city accrued more than that back.
Well, perhaps. Again, so we have a figure that comes out of the report that says if you look at all of the additional revenue that the hotels in Philadelphia County earned during those 4 days over and above the previous year, it's $1.2 million. If all of that can be attributed to the impact of the draft as opposed to other factors that could have affected that, and if all of that impact is a real impact, that is to say it's not a function of prices going up, but it's a function of increased visitors to Philadelphia, then maybe, sure, maybe there was a $1 million or $2 million or $5 million impact, and it only cost $500,000. That's possible. The numbers that are being put out, the $56 million raised to $94.9 million, are not credible based upon the methodology discussion that's provided in the report.
We certainly heard from residents in the vicinity who were, they say, adversely impacted by all the traffic and barriers during the stay, both the setup, the duration, and the teardown. But on the opposite end, how do economists put a value on the positive image that might accrue to a city, whether it's hosting a papal visit or the Democratic National Convention, or in this case, the NFL draft?
It's hard for me to believe that the image of Philadelphia changed appreciably because they hosted the draft. Again, as somebody who reads about sports every day, I didn't even remember that Philadelphia hosted the draft. Now, I'm sure there are some people in the United States, maybe it's all the people who showed up in Philadelphia, for whom that was meaningful, and they'll remember that. But just because Philadelphia hosted the draft doesn't mean that it's going to become a more desirable location for tourism or for trade or for investment or any other positive economic activity.
Would you cite some examples of public festivals or opportunities like this where it is beneficial for a city?
Well, frankly, I think a city has to be very cautious about committing to short-term events. And the way you would evaluate, it seems to me, whether to do something like this or not would be to have a very serious look, take a very serious look at the likelihood of an increased amount of tourism during those 3 or 4 days. Unfortunately, the study that's being presented publicly, I don't think has done that.
Professor, thanks so much for helping us make sense of the numbers.
I hope I did. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney is asking the public to submit ideas for the future of the statue of former Mayor Frank Rizzo. This comes as activists and some city council members have demanded the statue be moved from the Municipal Services Building Plaza. They cite Rizzo's record as police commissioner as reason for getting rid of it. After hearing comment, the city will decide whether to initiate the process for removal, which would involve hearings before the city's Art Commission. WHYY's Dave Davies spoke with activists and political leaders who battled with Rizzo in the 1960s and 70s when he was such a racially polarizing figure. Here's his report.
Many of the activists who regard Rizzo as a racist who doesn't deserve the honor of a prominent statue are too young to remember him as mayor. Anyone younger than 37 wasn't even born when Rizzo last held public office. Rizzo lived 11 years after his terms as mayor, and he was a very public figure. He ran for mayor three more times and hosted a daily radio show. His son, Frank Rizzo Jr., says in those years his views evolved and he became more moderate.
I think he got it that times changed and he was able to change. He was more tolerant. He didn't ask people to live by the same standard that he lived.
Have Rizzo's opponents from decades ago softened their view of him? Not much. Wilson Good, Philadelphia's first black mayor, went up against Rizzo twice in political campaigns, beating him in the 1983 mayoral primary and again in the general election 4 years later. Here's his take on Rizzo's legacy.
Frank Rizzo appealed to people who were primarily racist and who primarily wanted to keep African-Americans and other people in line.
Shelley Yanoff was active in progressive Democratic politics. She says Rizzo created a climate of fear when she and others were circulating recall petitions to remove him from office in 1976.
I had a young girl, about 8 at the time, my youngest, and I got calls saying, I see your daughter on her way to school. You better watch what you're saying.
Yanoff doesn't think Rizzo ordered any threats, but that he created an atmosphere that encouraged it among his followers. It's striking that given the strong feelings about Rizzo, there was so little public opposition when his supporters raised money for a statue and proposed mounting it in a prominent civic space across the street from City Hall. That was in 1994, and public views were probably softened by Rizzo's long time out of office, as well as the praise and tributes he got when he died suddenly in 1991. And there was the fact that the city had nearly gone broke in 1990, and the civic agenda was about fiscal stability and reviving Philadelphia's image. Here's how then-Mayor Ed Rendell remembers the discussion about the statue.
You know, they asked me, could it be placed at the Municipal Services Building? And I basically said, yeah, why not? You know, he was mayor, and why not?
Rendell now says it may not have been the right place for the statue, and if the Art Commission wants to move it, it should carefully consider what would be a better place. Good won't take a position because he has a policy as a former mayor of not commenting on decisions facing those in the mayor's office. One person of the era who has a nuanced view of Rizzo is State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams. His father, Hardy Williams, ran against Rizzo for mayor, and the senator says his family protested Rizzo's policies.
Frank Rizzo was a pretty complicated kind of guy. He, in my opinion, was the prototypical law and order kind of personality that ran a police department across America. Was he racist? Was he? I don't know. But I knew one thing. He met everybody with a nice stick.
Williams is not joining the chorus of those calling to remove the statue. A common refrain among former adversaries of Rizzo comes from Kevin Vaughn, an African-American gay man who served as director of the city's Human Relations Commission. He has nothing good to say about Rizzo, but can't get enthused about a crusade to move the statue.
It's not a mountain I would want to die on. It's not. This is not. There are many, many things that we can do in Philadelphia together to make Philadelphia a better place. Whether Frank Rizzo is standing in front of the Municipal Services Building forever or not is not one of those issues.
The city is inviting public comment until September 15th on ideas for the statue's future. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Efforts to improve roadway safety are intensifying in response to a nationwide surge in fatal bicycle crashes resulting from a collision with a motor vehicle. Joining me to make sense of the Governor's Highway Safety Association report is Randy Labasso, Communications Director at the Philadelphia Bicycle Coalition. Randy, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Now, it seems that for many years there was a decline in the number of bicycle fatalities, and then in the most recent year the numbers are available, 2015, a surge. What are some of the variables that might account for that?
So I think that any time you have a surge in people riding bicycles, you're going to see just a larger number of people getting injured and, unfortunately, fatalities on a bicycle.
So indeed, increased bicycle use, more miles on the road, is leading to greater opportunities for, unfortunately, a collision.
Sure. Since 2010 especially, we've seen a huge increase in bicycling, not only in Philadelphia, but across the entire nation. It's well known that in most major cities now, bicycling is a normal means of transportation to get to work, to get to school. And so you're seeing, unfortunately, more opportunities for people to get injured as they are riding the bikes.
And indeed, the study indicates that some 70% of these fatalities do take place in urban areas. Is that percentage, though, increasing?
I believe it is, yes. However, in Philadelphia, we have not seen the same increase as they've seen across the country in a lot of other cities. I think part of that has to do with the fact that we have had this bare-bones bicycle infrastructure. We were one of the first cities to have a real set of bike lanes back in the 90s installed under Mayor Rendell. And our streets, you know, they are small. People cannot go as fast as they can in a lot of other major cities.
People, and both bicyclists and cars?
Exactly, yeah. We have a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit. New York had a huge campaign to get their speed limit down to 25 miles an hour recently. There are certain streets in Center City. The lights are timed, so you can't really go more than 20 miles an hour. So I think some of these variables have really helped us get through this surge in fatalities.
By way of solution, the report offers what they call the three E's, and you're focusing so far on the first one, which they call engineering or infrastructure, but the others are education and enforcement. Where does Philadelphia stand in that regard?
Philadelphia and the Bicycle Coalition are focused on the three E's, but there are different ways to kind of look at that. So we, the Bicycle Coalition, has been pushing for something called Vision Zero for a long time, for the city to adopt this idea, which is basically using those three E's to get all traffic deaths in the city. And it sounds a little crazy when I say it, but to get them all down to zero. So our goal is to have zero people in cars, zero people walking, zero people in bicycles dying on the streets or getting severely injured.
And what are some of the ways to get close to that ultimate goal?
I mean, obviously, education is a big part of it. People need to know the rules of the road. A big one that we see, the people on bikes see, that a lot of people don't realize because it's a relatively young law, is the 4-foot passing rule. So in Pennsylvania, it is illegal to pass someone on a bicycle if you cannot provide 4 feet to get around them. On a lot of Philadelphia streets, especially these tiny colonial streets, it's impossible to get by somebody if you are without giving 4 feet.
Do you find that the Kenney administration is as receptive as previous iterations in terms of advancing a safer environment for bicyclists, pedestrians, and cars?
Jim Kenney pledged 30 miles of protected bike lanes when he came into office, and he pledged to create a Vision Zero platform. His administration has hired a complete streets director, and that person, along with the Office of Transportation Infrastructure Systems and other people in the administration, they are working on a series of recommendations and a report that should come out, I believe, in the fall. So he has been receptive. It is difficult, though, in Philadelphia as the mayor to say you want this and therefore it's going to happen because our legislative branch has similar executive powers over their districts that allow them to negate any kind of bicycle infrastructure that may go in and other things. But that's the one I'm focused on.
Randy, thanks for presumably pedaling over here and be safe getting where you're going next.
Thanks for having me.
Randy Labasso, Communications Director at the Philadelphia Bicycle Coalition. Some of the ancient terracotta warriors found in China in the 1970s will be coming to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia this fall. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the exhibition will focus on the science behind the great discovery.
It was in the 1970s that Chinese farmers digging a well near the city of Xi'an came across one of the great wonders of the ancient world, an entire army of life-size soldiers, about 6,000 strong, made of clay. The terracotta army was made for the burial site of the first emperor of China around 200 BC, so that he would be just as powerful in the afterlife as he was in this life. In October, 10 of those figures will travel to the Franklin Institute to be the centerpiece of an exhibition focusing not on why they were made, but how. The director of learning technology at the Franklin, Karen Alinich, says the Chinese emperor had mass-produced weapons of war using an assembly line technique. And in doing so, he learned that creating standardized parts, which could be easily interchangeable, would also enable an unskilled labor force to build a massive terracotta army and an entire empire.
From the top down, he had edicts for standardizing currency, written language, which previously there was no uniform script. He also put weights and measures into play. If trade amongst the peoples of the empire was ever going to succeed, standards for weights and measures were essential.
The Franklin Institute will push its own technology for this exhibition. Visitors will be able to download an augmented reality app to their phone while in the exhibition, allowing them to see additional features of the terracotta army not visible to the naked eye. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.